What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation.
Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. In 2015, astute e-discovery practitioners are looking for ways to take predictive coding to new heights, predictive coding 2.0, per se. Our guest today is a leader in e-discovery and predictive coding, and he is always looking for new and innovative ways to hone and perfect the predictive coding process. Specifically, he recently went on a quest for the holy grail of recall calculations, and he has devised a new approach to recall methods. Who is this predictive coding mastermind? He is Ralph Losey, shareholder at Jackson Lewis in Orlando. Ralph serves as the firm's National eDiscovery Council and head of litigation support. He is also a writer, researcher, and educator in the field of electronic discovery and legal search. Ralph is the founder of the Electronic Discovery Best Practices Group, edbp.com, and the developer of an online legal training course in e-discovery, e-discoveryteamtraining.com. And he is the principal author and publisher of the ediscoveryteam.com blog. Ralph, it's always good to have you on the ESI Report. Welcome back.
Why, thank you. I'm glad to report back on the Holy Grail.
So before we dig in on EI recall specifically, perhaps you could lay a foundation for our listeners. What we plan to cover today is very in-depth predictive coding. And when it comes to evaluating predictive coding measures, perhaps you could give us some of the go-to foundations just before we get too deep. Give us a high level.
Sure. Well, it's generally considered or traditionally considered recall, precision, and an F1 measure. And I think I can explain that easily by referring you to an oath, which is given thousands of times a day in courtrooms across the country. You may be familiar with it, where a person swears to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Everybody knows this. And actually, it's the key to understanding what recall and precision is. The whole truth, meaning getting all of the relevant information, that's recall. Nothing but the truth is precision. So if you get 100 documents and 90 of them are actually relevant, that's a precision of 90%. If the 90 documents you get are relevant, and there's a total of 180 relevant documents in the total collection defined, then you've got a recall of 50%. So it's a matter of getting the whole truth, which is honestly, hopefully we'll get into that briefly, that's not even possible anymore in today's world. But that's basically the three traditional measures that people have looked at is how much of the truth you've gotten, recall, how precise you are in only retrieving relevant or information, that's precision. And then this F1 is sort of a mathematical blend of the two that emphasizes recall over precision by a little bit, so it's not a simple average. So traditionally, those have been the measures that we've looked to in order to evaluate the effectiveness of a search project.
And so what are some of the limitations of calculating these measures when it comes to evaluating how successful a predictive coding exercise was within a discovery review?
Well, actually, the measures of precision in F1 I don't think matter much anymore under today's modern review procedures. Let me explain why. Today, most of the reviews that I'm familiar with, and you know, I talk to everybody in the community, most everyone is doing what's called a two-pass review now in large projects. The first pass is done by subject matter experts and professionals in the predictive coding and the computer itself, where the computer will basically identify what it believes the most relevant documents are. And that's the first pass, which is done with computer and human experts. And then with that batch of documents that have been predicted relevant, then the second pass occurs where you bring in contract lawyers and other human lawyers only to do two things, basically. Number one, to verify the computer was right, that they're relevant. And number two, to look for confidentiality and to appropriately label confidential documents or remove the privileged documents and that sort of thing. So by having this double pass at relevancy, we're always going to have a very high prevalence rate. I mean, I think I'm at near 100% now that I've, you know, had it by computer and then verified it again. So that's not really the issue. The issue now is recall. That's what everybody's focused on. So that's a change, and you know, as far as our traditional measures. Now, another limitation is the fact that we really have too much data in order to ever know for sure what recall is. There's just so much, you know, this whole business of the truth, the whole truth. I've been saying since 2006, we can't afford the whole truth because it would take millions of dollars even to verify 50,000 or 100,000 documents. And even then it would be wrong because of the inability of humans to agree with each other. And I've written about this at length. I don't want to go into a lot of time with it. Just take my word for it that you can never know for sure what your recall is. You can only do estimates. And that's okay because under Rule 26G, which is what lawyers have to sign to certify, we're not required to produce all relevant documents. Get it? We're only required to certify that we made a reasonable effort to find and produce all relevant documents. So the rule itself is compatible with the technological realities of there being so much information where it's common to have to search through a million emails to find the 10,000 or 100,000 that may be relevant. The other limitation is that it is impossible to know recall as a point, as a specific number. And I've gone at length in writing about this, talked to the top statisticians and scientists in the world. They all agree about this, that you can never know through using random sampling to determine recall what exactly your recall is. You can only know a range. So you can know that you've attained a recall of 70 to 90%, for example, but you can never know for sure that you've attained a recall in the middle of 80%. So this is, you know, it is an inherent limitation in recall that a lot of people sort of gloss over. Instead, they focus on a point or one number. The reality is there is never one particular number. It's always a range. And another you know, limitation of this is that there is no set minimum recall percentage that you should attain in any review project in order to meet the requirements of 26G of reasonable efforts. And so even though maybe popular to say, gee, you got to attain 80% recall, there is no such rule to that effect. And it varies according to every project that you have. Some projects are more difficult than others. So that's another limitation is that there is no, easy answer of, well, here's the number you need to reach, and if you reach it, you're good. If you don't reach it, you're not good. It's not quite that simple.
So enter EI recall, something that you put a lot of work into developing, a new methodology for recall. How would you describe EI recall for listeners?
So EI recall takes all these limitations into consideration and comes up with a simple way to calculate a recall range. And by the way, it's probably the hardest essay I ever wrote or blog explaining all of this. And it was hard because I went to great efforts to make it simple and gave maybe, you know, 10 different examples and show you how to do the math. The math is easy. It's ninth grade level math. It's basically multiplication and division. It's all that's required in looking up on tables. And all you have to do is Google EI-recall. EI-recall. Google that. Know where my article is, and you can see all of this in detail. So bottom line is I urge you to take advantage of the fact that I've literally spent hundreds of hours researching all possible methods, talking to the scientists, talking to the experts, and trying a number of alternatives till I came up with this. So I'm going to give you the high-level overview on what it is. But basically, what you do is at the end of a review project or near the end of a project, you take a look, you do a random sample of all of the documents that you're not going to produce. I call this the negatives. These are documents that you have determined are irrelevant based upon the predictive coding ranking or based upon your looking at them and determining them irrelevant. You can take a random sample to look for documents that you're not going to produce that actually you should have produced. That's called a false negative. You're looking for documents that are not going to be produced that are, in fact, relevant. And the reality is there's always going to be mistakes made. If you take a large enough sample, and I always recommend a sample of at least 1,500, that gives you what's called a confidence interval of 2.5% under a confidence level of 95%. And again, this is basic sampling, and I spell all this out in the article. But if you take a sample of that size, you're almost always going to find some mistakes made. And based upon the number of mistakes that you make, you determine the range, because remember, sampling always creates a range of a high number of total documents that you likely missed in the whole project and a low number of total documents you likely missed in the whole project. So you, by using the low end of the recall range, you do that by dividing the highest number of relevant documents that you could have missed under the sample, and you add that to the relevant documents that you did find, and you divide that sum into the relevant documents that you did find, and then you have your low end of your recall range. Do the opposite to calculate your high end of the recall range by using the lowest number of projected relevant documents that you missed, the lowest number of errors in the range, and dividing that into what you did find. And that's how you calculate a recall level, by looking at the documents that you missed. This is called an illusion test. That's where the E comes from, and the I in EI. I stands for interval, because it incorporates the two values, which is the way mathematics and sampling works in doing projections like this in an estimate. And it gives you, again, something like a range between 70 and 90. And so you'll know that somewhere in there you have, that's the recall you've attained. Now, in some projects, I've seen recall very high, where the range is between 90 and 96. That is incredibly high. The Trek Legal Track, they were getting recall ranges in anywhere from 40% to 70. And so, you know, anything over, when you get into the 50, and between 50 and 60, between 70 and 80 is very good, between 80 and 100, extremely good. But you're always calculating the range by looking at the documents that you missed. So that's basically, you know, the approach of how it works. And for the details and seeing it, I urge you to you know, read the article where I spell it out in tremendous detail.
So in that article, Ralph, you talk about the five basic advantages to EI recall, and you talk about those briefly. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of those five advantages?
Yeah, happy to. This is why I think the EI recall that I've come up with, which, by the way, after I came up with it and published it, I had some other scientists say, oh, yeah, this is what we use all the time anyway, which was great, only they hadn't written it up, and I've written it up and shared it. But the number one advantage is it's mathematically correct in that it calculates a recall as a range. If you use a formula that doesn't calculate recall as a range, you're wrong. It just won't stand up to scientific scrutiny. It's just not the way random sampling works. So that's the number one advantage, is they're not just calculating one number, I'm calculating two numbers. The highest possible recall that the sampling shows and the lowest possible recall the sampling shows. You'll never know for sure if you're in the low end or the high end. You'll only know that 95 times out of 100, you're somewhere in that range. That's the uncertainty that is inherent in all sampling. That is, you know, one of the weaknesses of any sampling. But at least it's honest and true in that it calculates both ends of the range. That's the number one advantage, is that it's correct because it has range. Number two, the advantage of this method is it only requires one random sample. Only one time do you have to take a sample. I, you know, typically do 1,500 documents. Other methods, you have to take multiple samples. And anytime you take multiple samples, this increases the uncertainties inherent in having multiple reviews of a sample. So one sample is really the most reliable way to go. the third advantage of this is that this sample is taken at the end of the project. Other methods take a sample at the beginning of a project, or they take one in the beginning and the end. The problem of taking a beginning sample is that you're not really sure of what your relevance is at the beginning of a project. It's been proven time and time again. I've never been involved in a big review project where we haven't improved our understanding of relevance over the life of the review. It's a thing called concept drift. And so your understanding of relevance at the beginning of a project is at its weakest point. Conversely, at the end of the project, your understanding of relevance is very good. Now it's totally refined. You've got it down pat. So that is the time to take your sample, is at the end of the project, after you've fully developed your understanding of what's relevant and what isn't. The fourth advantage is that my method, EI recall method, uses in its formula documents that have already been confirmed to be relevant by not one, but by two passes, what I mentioned before, the double pass, been confirmed relevant by the artificial intelligence in your software, has been confirmed relevant by actual contract lawyers reviewing the documents to say, yeah, the computer got it right, or no, the computer made a mistake, in this case, it's not really relevant. So it's a double pass, so that improves the accuracy. By the way, in most projects that I'm working on now, after we train the document, the computer is getting it right 80 to 90% of the time, which under the previous methods was already considered extremely high precision. So now coming into the contract lawyers, we've already got 80 to 90% of them the computer got right. So the contract lawyers are just weeding out maybe the 10 to 20% errors that are made as part of their second pass review effort. So that makes it more reliable. And the fifth thing is, even though it may not seem like it when I'm trying to explain this verbally, this is really a simple method to employ. It's simple math. It's simple lookup. It doesn't require you to hire an expert. The experts have already vetted this stuff out. You can do it by looking at the article. You can do it yourself, and you can explain it. You can refer to this article. And so it's easy to use. So those are the five main advantages of it.
So how do you address some of the criticisms that you've received or the potential criticisms, Ralph, with regards to this recall model, assuming that you've come across folks that maybe have found some areas to comment on?
Well, I criticize it as well. I mean, it is inherent in any random sampling. There are weaknesses on it. The first criticism I've been able to overcome, I think, and I don't see anybody disagreeing with my response to this criticism yet, but the first criticism is, well, wait a minute. Your method, you're finding mistakes. You're finding these false negatives. You're finding a document predicted by the computer to be irrelevant, but that prediction was false, so it's a false negative. I mean, shouldn't you, if the computer's made mistakes, shouldn't you just keep going until you don't find any mistakes? That's one criticism of the method, is that it's built on the fact that there are mistakes. The answer to that is, well, there's always going to be mistakes in a large project, and perfection is impossible for reasons that scientists have proven over and over again, having in large part to do with the kind of inherent subjectivity in making a relevance determination to begin with, much less in being able to measure it with multiple people having different opinions on what's relevant or what isn't. But the primary point is, I also couple with the EI recall test, which is a test of effectiveness, I couple another test that is what's called accept on zero error kind of quality assurance test. Except on zero error. That means if I find any errors in this particular test, then I do go back and start over. The error that I will never accept is if when I take a random sample of the negative documents, ones not to be produced, and I find any highly relevant documents, I find a hot document, I will not accept that error. That means that the computer and the experts program the computer have made a mistake. Then you have to go back and do further training and find the documents and look for more documents like that. In addition, if I found an error that is not a hot document, but it's a strong relevant document and it's of a kind of document, kind of relevance proof that I've not seen before, that again is something that is an error I will not accept and I'll go back to training. On the other hand, if the error I find is just what everybody calls more of the same, yet another document that you've already seen 30 times in a slightly different form. It's not an exact duplicate, but it's similar. Accumulative evidence, it doesn't matter. Nobody cares about merely relevant documents. If it's a document like that, then it passes, and it doesn't matter that this is a false negative. It doesn't matter that you produced it. But if it's a document that matters, then we go back to the drawing boards. That's what the accept on zero error part is. The second criticism I get, which is inherent in sampling, and there's just nothing you can do about it, is what do you deal with a situation that's called the low prevalence situation? By that I mean, for example, what if there's less than a half of 1% of documents in a collection are relevant? In a situation like that, there's so few relevant documents that it becomes much harder to calculate a range based upon a random sample. All sampling kind of breaks down when you're looking for something that is extremely rare. You cannot have a sample of 30,000 documents in order to do this test. That doesn't work because of cost and because 30,000 documents require contract lawyers to be making decisions so that they're going to be inconsistent on it, so it doesn't work. So there is that inherent limitation in any low prevalence situation. I think that the EI recall I decided was the best because at least it doesn't try to camouflage this. It does show the range. So you may have a very high range of between 30% and 70%, 40% range. And that kind of thing can happen in low prevalence, but at least you are aware of that, whereas other methods kind of hide this defect. And the other reason I think it's okay to still use recall as a measure of assurance, even in these very low prevalence situations, which are not that uncommon. You know, when you're looking for documents that very few of them exist that are responsive or relevant. The reason that you need to at least try to have recall is that it's better than nothing. And the reason that it's acceptable is it's not the only thing that you're doing to try and measure the effectiveness of your search. You're doing a number of other things, or you should be, in order to measure your compliance with Rule 26G of reasonable efforts. The other facts that that you should look to and should try to include in your review in order to make up for the kind of limitations of any recall, particularly recall of low prevalence, is number one, the qualifications of the attorneys who are directing the review, the qualifications of your subject matter experts that are training the computer, the qualifications of the actual document reviewers themselves, and of the document reviewer managers. In other words, the experience and quality of the people involved are a very good indication of your quality control overall. Not by themselves, because even smart, experienced people can make mistakes, but it's a good indication. Another indication to look for is to limit the number of contract reviewers that are used. Every time you add another reviewer to a project, you are adding more error. If you did like Verizon did 10 years ago, the old-fashioned way, in the famous study that was written up by EDI, Patrick Hoot and Herb Roydblatt, where they had 100 different contract lawyers, they had a consistency rate of only 20%, which means 80% of the time people were inconsistent. Well, you might as well be using a dartboard if that's what you're going to do. Every time you add additional reviewers, due to the human limitations, you're going to add more mistakes. To me, the ideal review team is 3 people, maybe 4 or 5 people. When you get into 30 or 40, forget about it. Then you had better have a very high recall because you're going to have mistakes. That's just the way it works. The other thing to look at for quality assurance is, and this is critical, how good is the software? Is this proven software? Has it been around? Has it been verified? Has it been tested? And even more important than the software itself, how good are the actual training methods used in your predictive coding? We're all about methods nowadays, so this is just this is a method of quality assurance, but what about the method of training? Are you using multimodal? Are you using the uncertainty principles? All of the kind of things that people are writing about and doing experiments on now, that is key. In fact, the one experiment we have from the Electronic Discovery Institute, it was an Oracle experiment, they found that the methods were more important than the software itself. And so, too, were experienced, knowledgeable lawyers. So that, we come back full circle again. You really need to have people that know what they're doing as the ultimate buttress to also doing recall calculations. In fact, the math and the recall and the sampling, they're really the icing on the cake. The cake itself is sound methodology by experienced personnel.
So, Ralph, that really wraps up the time we have today for the ESI report. But before we go, I know that you mentioned a couple of resources that listeners could go to learn more about EI recall and to really dig deeper on the research behind this aspect of predictive coding. Could you give us a little bit of direction again on where those resources are available?
Yes, thank you for that. So the main publication that I write to share my research and whatever my studies are is a blog, a professional blog that is eDiscovery Team. That's e-discoveryteam.com. I've been actually writing that blog for 8 years now, Michelle, if you can believe it, and recently switched from a weekly blog to a monthly blog because I tend to write a longer, a very analytic articles on this blog. And there, if you search EI Recall, you'll find my writings on this. Another website that I think is a good resource for your readers, listeners, and one of the more about predictive coding is one called LegalSearchScience.com. LegalSearchScience.com. There I put together the basic overview of the methods that the scientists and the experiments are doing and practitioners who specialize in this area of the law are finding about what are the best methods to do predictive coding, to be training the computer. So those would be the two primary resources I would ask people to check out.
Well, congratulations on 8 years on the blog. That's an outstanding milestone. And thanks again for joining me on the ESI Report.
Thank you, Michelle. Good talking to you.
Well, that wraps up another edition of the ESI Report. Thank you to everyone who's listening, and thanks to Kroll OnTrack for sponsoring the show. If you want to make sure you are in the eDiscovery know, make sure you check out the eDiscovery.com website or follow Kroll OnTrack on the eDiscoveryblog.com. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. Be sure to follow Kroll OnTrack on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll OnTrack's software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.